Poor sleep doesn't always have the same one cause. Are you anxious? Are your thoughts racing? Is your cortisol increasing close to bedtime? Do you have a problem falling asleep? Or do you have a problem staying asleep? Or is it both?
What would cause cortisol to spike?
So traditionally, stress is going to cause a cortisol spike, but also anything that's stressful for the body is going to cause cortisol to spike. Blood sugar spikes and crashes are stressful, releasing cortisol. So we're demanding of our adrenals to produce more and more and more cortisol. Pretty soon they get tired. So whether we have very, very low or very, very high cortisol levels, when we try to fall asleep, if it's outside of that normal range, we either won't have an easy time falling asleep or we'll wake up. And often that sugar crash is at 2 to 3 in the morning, and that blood sugar is crashing a few hours later, causing a cortisol spike. When your cortisol is spiking for whatever reason, now you're alert and you can't fall back asleep.
Tribe listeners, I have an extremely exciting announcement for all of you. Do you want to come hang out with Cody Sanchez, David Osborne, David Green, Rich Roll, and even yours truly down in Austin, Texas? Well, let's do it. May 1st, 2nd, and 3rd, for the first time ever, GoBundance, the exclusive millionaire membership group, is opening up an event to anyone, man, woman, millionaire or not, and we're calling it the Austin Entrepreneurial Summit. At the AES, you'll meet all those people I mentioned, plus GoBundance members on both the men's and women's side, and I'll be there hanging out the entire time. Every event I've ever attended for GoBundance has given me a disproportionate return on the money spent and the time spent to get there. And this is the biggest one that GoBundance has ever done. So if you're a member, not a member, and you're looking to supercharge the second part of your year 2024, this event in May is a great way to get that all kickstarted. Go to GoBundance.com/AES right now for early bird pricing for members and guests. And warning, the power of GoBundance events is that it holds you accountable long after you're gone to achieving whatever goals you've set. So this event will change your life. GoBundance.com/AES. I'll see you there. Let's get back to the show. What's going on, everybody? Welcome to the Tribe of Millionaires podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Gruber. And today's guest, Joya Vanderlaan, is an entrepreneur, an incredible businesswoman. She has a background in medical, and she has started the company Nourish House Calls, which is a functional and regenerative medicine practice in Illinois. We're going to dive in on exactly what that means, first off, and how that can help you as you consider your medical options going forward. So Joya, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
That's good to see you. It's been, about a month since I saw you in Chicago.
I think so in Chicago. Yeah, that was an easy meetup for us.
It was. I like the rooftop discussions at Trump Tower. They went places.
They went a lot of places.
But I appreciate it. I like just learning about what you did there. And you, of course, sponsored an event I was hosting there, which was incredible. And then hearing what you talk about it more from the stage, it's like, you know, we got to get on and talk about this a little bit more. So let's start with this. What exactly is regenerative and functional medicine? Can you describe that for us?
Sure. First, besides being a tongue twister. So functional medicine is my love, my passion. That's kind of where I started. And it's basically looking deeper into problems that people are having or symptoms that they're having, and not just providing Band-Aid solutions. A lot of traditional medicine involves Band-Aid solutions. It doesn't really fix anything. It may help your symptoms for a period of time, but it doesn't really look at the root cause or root causes. And functional medicine really aims to look at and solve root causes of what is going on in a person's body. I love it because I love asking questions and I love understanding the whys. And there's a lot of understanding and asking, why does this happen? And how can we fix that? If you understand the why, it's much easier to understand the fix.
How do you, you said you came from that space to begin with, because what I understand of your background being I forget the nursing levels. What's the nurse, the level that you were was the,
yeah. So I first got a bachelor's and was a registered nurse, and then got my master's, which I am now a nurse practitioner. So I have prescribing rights and all that. Yeah.
Right. I always mess up the levels, if you will, of nursing and what they can do and everything. So nurse
They've
practitioner.
Made it confusing. Yeah.
But as a nurse practitioner, you would start in the traditional medicine space, would you not? Like when you say you started in functional, what does that mean?
So actually when I graduated with my master's, I immediately had our first baby, but then my first job 3 months or so later, when I started that, the reason I chose to work at that particular office was because they did functional medicine and I knew I wanted to do that. Now, that was also a pain management practice. And so I was prescribing all of the things and managing people's pain, whether that was with medication. We did injections and physical therapy, and we did a lot of kind of, you know, psychological therapy and help at that place too. And so there was a lot of traditional medicine to that. And certainly my days at Northwestern as a registered nurse were very, very traditional. But I always had that kind of knowledge or feeling inside that we're missing something, right? Like we're catching disease too late. We're not really educating on diet and exercise and sleep and stress. There's more to it than what we're initially taught in medical school or in nurse practitioner school.
Yeah. What is it about something, a practice like that? I'm just kind of the business end of it for a moment here. So what I hear you saying is, hey, look, functional medicine gets to root cause. Traditional medicine masks the cause or masks the symptoms with this pill or this treatment or whatever it might be. Why? The cost in my eyes, the cost of preventative long-term is way less than the cost of masking and going the traditional route. So what is the business? How is it set up such that most medical practitioners are traditional and they're prescribing people out of their symptoms?
Well, how deep down this conspiracy theory hole do you want me to get here?
Let's go. I want to hear.
So we have to follow the money, right? The money and power really is what it comes down to. So I'll give you my stance on it. Who pays for medical education? Who supports the medical schools? You know, the AMA does, the American Medical Association. And they have their agenda, like all of us have our agenda. And then there's the insurance companies, and they have to profit, right? The insurance companies are not this nice, group of companies that just is there for us and really cares for us. They stand to profit, and they profit a ton. Mm-hmm. They profit more when we stay sick. Hospitals profit when we stay sick. They don't profit when they get us better. Yeah. And so that is kind of like the simple version of why the medical system kind of is the way it is.
What's the AMA's agenda?
They're very conservative. One of their agendas is to not let nurse practitioners practice independently. So I kind of have a bit of business with them, bone to pick with them. hopefully nobody's listening from the AMA. I believe, and I've done a lot of reading on this, and of course I may not remember everything right. They want doctors trained in a certain way, and they're also supported by the pharmaceutical companies. And so in order for pharmaceutical companies to continue to profit, the pharmaceutical companies need to develop relationships not only with the AMA and therefore medical schools, but also with politicians, which is a conflict of interest in many cases as well.
So the AMA is funded by pharmaceutical companies?
No, I don't want to say that that's true, but there are connections there, and whether or not you can find them. And this is why I'm talking like, okay, is this a conspiracy? Right.
Yeah, I get it.
How deep do you want to get into, well, is BlackRock really above all of them? You know, like, I don't know.
Wow. Well, it makes sense. Like, you know, when you think about pharmaceutical companies funding, pharmaceutical companies paying for media, right? Like that's something that came in the late 90s, I think it was, where it was no longer illegal or no longer, unethical for a pharmaceutical company to run ads and pay for media. So all of the media interest is to push COVID vaccine or whatever.
Well, and there's some evidence, and I've read this in a few different books, that the pharmaceutical companies own somewhere around 66% of mass media.
That scares the hell out of me. Holy cow. And then to your point, whether it's funding or lobbying or special interest or connection to have influence in any way over the AMA, which is the governing body, right? For all things medical in the country or all things educationally.
In many ways. Mm-hmm.
Right.
We're kind of like the most well-known.
Right, right. For them to have that kind of influence over any level of influence over the AMA, which then sets the guidelines out there, that's scary. Is there then in the functional medicine space, is the biggest block that there's no third party payments, there's no insurance, there's no anything that covers somebody who chooses the functional route, or is that changing?
So it's not changing towards insurance. In fact, it's more getting away from the insurance model for a lot of reasons. There are people out there who are trying to run an insurance-based practice and still practice functional medicine. The problem is reimbursements are so small, and in order to profit as a business, you would need volume, and functional medicine just cannot be a volume business, especially for one provider, because the average medical visit is around 7 minutes long. Okay. So no wonder nobody's getting better. I couldn't do what I do in 7 minutes. I couldn't get to the root cause and help you and counsel you and prescribe what needs to be prescribed or talk about supplements or educate you in 7 minutes. There's no way. So, but that's what these kind of more traditional insurance-based practices have to do, because otherwise the profit is less. So it's a factory. It's churning out. So it's very reactive care and very little proactive care.
Here's a question that I'll ask, and then I want to talk about Nourish, the genesis of it, so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. But when I lived in the States, when I lived in the US, I didn't have traditional insurance. I had a health share company, which mm-hmm. is like voodoo to a hospital or doctor group. They have no idea what it is. So when I would walk in initially and say, I have a health share, and give them this card, which looks like health insurance, you know, they're like, okay, they send a bill and nothing would happen. So my health share actually told me to just tell them that I'm self-insured.
Exactly. Right?
I'm self-insured. When I do that, my prescription medication bill was next to nothing to pay for it out of pocket. And the cost of treatment, I spent hours in an ENT because my ear was bleeding, bad infection, like inflamed bleeding. Ooh. Went to this ENT. They put me in like a room with this like metal apparatus on, and they're like banging on it to like make sure that the hearing loss isn't in my, like, you know, they're testing my hearing and everything. Like 3 hours. And I only could imagine what this bill was going to be. I walked out, told them I'm self-insured. They handed me a bill for $150. And it said, bill at the uninsured rate.
Yes.
What is that?
Different rates. Oh, there's different rates. I get this with lab companies all the time. So the labs that I order through Quest and LabCorp is the same. I'll order labs. It's like $4,000 worth, right? And so if a patient has insurance, oftentimes they'll end up owing between $50 and $250. But you can get these same labs at cash pay rates for $800. So $4,000 worth of labs for $600 to $800. Now, I usually do run it through insurance because most of my patients do have insurance. And if they can use it, they want to use it. It's interesting.
Where does that money go, though? Follow that money for me. So, all right. So I walk in, it's $800. I bill insurance, it's $4,000. Mm-hmm. So what happens with the $4,000?
I can't claim to know exactly. Some of it's a little voodoo. I think it's write-offs. It has to do with write-offs, maybe. Like, okay, the lab company bills insurance that $4,000, and they can write off then the $3,200. And then taxes. I don't know. I haven't spent time totally thinking that through entirely. I just know what I see on my end.
Well, all of this paints the picture, which is, you know, like our medical system is just, it's convoluted, it's confusing. And like I said, that was such an eye opener for me, not only from a standpoint of the medical system, but like so many people are sticking in a job they don't want when they have opportunities to go do something else because of healthcare, because of health insurance, I should
say. Absolutely. We're paying almost $3,000 a month.
Go to a health share. What are you doing?
We can't because Sophie has autism, and they will not take kids with autism. We looked into that when I went independent. Yeah. So we're stuck.
It
does. Right now.
It is the downside. Health shares. The downside to them is they are, if you've got a family of 4, 5, 6, whatever, and you know no medical history of significance, you're kind of like, yeah, we treat once a year. Awesome. You've got pre-existing conditions, diabetes, even cancer. Kids with autism. Not awesome. So,
which I get from their perspective, right? The potential for her to be a drain on their system is high.
Yep, absolutely. Yep. But all right. So you, with knowing all of this convoluted mess in the medical system, you skew fully functional, fully regenerative, and Nourish is born. What was the, what were some of the tenets that you brought to, it's called Nourish House Calls, which is interesting too. So what is Nourish? Why is it Nourish House Calls? Give me some of the decision-making that you made on that.
Right. So, I was becoming less happy in the pain management job and realizing, you know, I kind of wanted to do things my own way. And I spent probably 2 years looking for a practice to work for, because at that time we had, I think the twins were four or five, and Sophie was 6 or 7. And so the last thing I wanted to do was start my own business. But it really came down to that was going to be the best choice. And Dave really encouraged me to do it, and he thought I could do it. I wasn't so sure, but turns out, yes, he was right. And so I really wanted to do low overhead because I still had young kids at home, and it was important to me to still be a good mom and have time for my kids, right? I didn't want to be a full-time, gone all the time mom. So I wanted low overhead because I didn't really want a whole lot of pressure. Dave was still working at the law firm at that time. And so this was a good way for me to kind of be able to keep practicing, because I need to practice in order to keep my license. Yeah. And help people, do what I love, and kind of dip my toes in and just see, you know, could this work? So I didn't want to rent space. And so I remember seeing on Facebook a physical therapist who was advertising a course for doing physical therapy in a house call model. And I loved it. I thought, well, I'm not renting an office then. So that's immediately like one of the biggest costs. And it's so personalized. I can be in people's homes. I can smell. Are they using air fresheners? Are they using candles? What are they using to clean their house? Could there be mold in their house? Am I smelling anything, right? And so as kind of a jumping off point for, well, you're having headaches all the time. Is it the Febreze that you're using, or those Glade plugins that have all the chemicals that, you know, it's on the shelf in the US, right? So it must be healthy. Well, we make that assumption all the time, so wrongly. Anyway, so I wanted to be able to do that and practice the way I wanted to practice. I also didn't want to be bound by insurance's rules for how I treated patients. I know better than the insurance companies how to take care of a patient, because I am the medical professional. But they dictate what we can do, how we can do, how often we can do it, what tests we can order, what they'll pay for. So a cash-based practice just made sense to me. I'm in DuPage County in Illinois, and it's a ripe area for this type of medicine. You know, were I in rural, you know, West Virginia, this model may not work as well. But it's a fairly affluent area, and it's an area where people really value their health and know they don't know enough to take care of themselves. And a lot of them don't have the time to invest in educating themselves as fully as they would like to. And so hire somebody like me to, you know, make sure we're checking all the boxes, both preventatively, but also symptom-wise. I get a lot of men and women with hormone imbalances, and that affects your whole life. And so if it's affecting your life, you're going to pay somebody, even outside of insurance, you're willing to pay somebody to help you with that, because you're not sleeping, you're not thinking straight, your muscles are sore, your, you know, libido is terrible. It just leads to all these things that impact just about every area of your life, whether you're a man or a woman.
Is there a common hormonal imbalance that affects most, let's say, men to start there?
Well, testosterone for sure. And it's interesting, if you look at data over the decades, men's testosterone levels today are about half of what they were, say, like 40 years ago.
What do you attribute that to? There's a lot of theories, but what's your research or your thoughts?
I think it's not just one thing. I think it's a lot of different things. I think it's exposure. We're exposed to a lot of things, both in our air and in our food and things we inject into our bodies. And then marijuana also decreases sperm count and testosterone. So it's a lot of different things. Certainly the food quality that we're eating now is poor compared to what we were eating 40 years ago. So it's a lot of different things, but it's concerning because we're, you know, emasculating men. We have men who are less masculine. And so as a society, that's concerning.
Why is that concerning to you?
Well, you have less testosterone. You are less willing to kind of stand up for what you think. You have less oomph, right? So it's easier to convince that population of certain things too, right? And have them go along with whatever agenda is being pushed. Again, I'm being real conspiracy theorist.
Yeah, I love here. This is what we're doing. Yeah, absolutely.
But, yeah, we have to think about it that way, right? Because if we're not on the lookout for it, if we're not aware that that's a possibility, then that's trouble. If we're not, you know, aware that this kind of stuff could happen.
Is this worldwide, or is this more U.S. based or developed nation?
I know the numbers for the US.
Okay.
I'm not sure I know numbers for other. I don't know numbers for other countries.
Are you familiar with what the reason Kellogg's cornflakes were made?
Oh, I did hear this story, but I wouldn't be able to tell
this
it back
real.
To you.
This isn't conspiracy. Yeah. So the guy that Dr. Kellogg, whatever the hell his first name is, Dr. Kellogg believed that sex and even just the concept of ejaculation, anyway, no matter what, like personally doing it or having sex with somebody else was dirty and ungodlike. So he, before cornflakes, he came up with all of these inventions to stifle sex drive, including, this is the sickest one, listen, Google it. If somebody doesn't believe me, just
this is
absolutely familiar. Truth. He had, I think, either filed for a patent or was trying to invent for boys, like a metal rod that would hold an erection down. Like you would have it sewn in at a young age. Crazy stuff. So anyway, in order to get to the masses, he tried to develop a bland food that people would eat that would stifle sex drive. Nobody wanted to eat it. So what does he add? Sugar. Lots and lots of sugar. So the Kellogg's cornflakes, one of the most popular, well-known, yeah, widely spread cereals, foods in the United States forever, is literally made, or was literally made, to lower libido. That's like, no bullshit. I unbelievable, but that's what you're describing.
You know who funded the formation of the food pyramid too, right? Like who paid to get on the bottom of that food pyramid?
What's the bottom? The wheat?
The grains and the
grains.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. No.
Yeah. Wonder Bread? The grain council. Like there's a grain council. There's a dairy council. Yeah. They paid to get down there.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Layer vegetables so down there.
I know. That's insane. But yeah, none of this sounds like conspiracy to me, to your point about testosterone being half what it was and trying to
not
lower
hormones. Data. Yeah.
Right. What about women? Same thing. Is it estrogen counts, estrogen levels, same sort of culprit, or is there something different?
So estrogen is a big one. And especially when we're talking about women approaching menopause and approaching, I mean, 10 years before. So the average age is 50, 51 for when women go through menopause. But the changes start 10 years before that. And we're not taught that. And so we're not looking out for it. So a lot of women after 40 will start to gain weight and feel depressed or anxious. They're not sleeping well. They're eating and exercising the same, but their bodies are not behaving well. And they're discouraged because they're gaining like this middle kind of fatty tire and they get soft. Libido goes down, vaginal dryness. And again, that affects all kinds of areas of life. And now, and their brains aren't functioning, their memory is going. So their marriages are affected, their parenting is affected, their jobs are affected. But they're told, well, you're depressed, so we'll just give you an antidepressant. You're not sleeping, so let's give you a sleeping pill. But again, we're not really addressing the cause here. We're addressing symptoms. But even sleeping pills, many of them do not allow you to get into that stage 4 deep restorative sleep. And so, yes, you're out, but are you getting the deep restorative sleep and cleaning out your brain and regenerating your cells and producing growth hormone like you really should in those like valuable sleep stages? No. And so then after a while, women often will go, well, why am I on this? Like, it's an antidepressant, but I'm not really depressed. So then we test hormones. Estrogen is often low. Progesterone is very often low. Even testosterone in women is often very low. And another less known hormone, DHEA, which is somewhat a precursor to testosterone, but also valuable in and of itself, is often low. And that combination just tanks women. Hmm.
That's crazy. How much of the work you do, I guess almost like ranking it, mm-hmm, how much of it is sleep optimization versus, say, hormone imbalance or something else for that matter?
So it's hard to kind of suss that out because it's all so intertwined. How I like to think about health and kind of body systems is like a spider web where the areas where the two strings, you know, attach are nodes basically. And you affect one, you pull on one, and the whole thing moves. So by affecting one piece, you can really affect all of it. So for example, if progesterone is low, a woman is not going to be sleeping well, partially because you just don't sleep well when you don't have progesterone, but partially because those racing thoughts and that anxiety then is preventing good sleep. Yeah. And when estrogen is low, now you're getting hot flashes. That also prevents good sleep. They're waking up literally with soaking wet pajamas or sheets. And I've literally had women tell me, I can wring out sweat out of my pajamas. That is how much the sweating is. Yeah. And then when testosterone is low too, maybe you're not getting a lot done during the day, or you're not motivated to exercise, you're not building muscle. And so you're not active during the day, you're not going to sleep well at night. So it all plays a part.
Gotcha. What is the how do I ask this? Because sleep optimization is something that's becoming more and more on my radar right now. For sure. I guess I'll ask it broadly. Mm-hmm. What are things people need to know? And maybe beyond put your cell phone down, what are things people need to know or do, or some, you know, again, this is generalized, but what's common in your practice or common when you find people like, hey, because it feels like sleep is the, if you had to pick something to get right or to do sleep really well with.
Huge.
Right? Sleep. You get sleep, everything else kind of follows with it. So what are a few things people that you treat or that you see or that you've done the research on that people can do to start to look at how they can get better sleep or optimize their sleep?
Yeah. So, you know, the typical sleep hygiene things are important. Cold room, dark room, no screens, don't eat for a few hours before bed, like these things. But beyond that, and that doesn't work for a lot of people. It's important to do, but it's often not enough. Alcohol before bed. I don't care if you think it helps you sleep. I promise you it does not. Mm-hmm. And even if it does help you close your eyes all night, again, it prevents you from getting in that deep, valuable sleep. If you're going to spend time sleeping, you want to have it be restorative, valuable sleep. So alcohol is a big one. Stabilizing, optimizing hormones really helps with that too. Even listening to things like delta wave music. Delta waves are the waves that we experience in our deep sleep. And there's actually recordings on YouTube, on Spotify that you can even listen to. And there's 8 hour long tracks. So you can have it on just barely so you can hear it all night long. Even things like I wear an Oura ring, Dave does as well. And so tracking it and figuring out for your body, what affects the sleep? Is it, you know, you can't eat within 3 hours. It's not 2 hours for you, it's 3 hours of sleeping. And then, and track that. And you can then, you know, apply an intervention, track the effect and know whether for your body that works or not. Part of what I also do with sleep is, and this kind of gets back to the functional medicine piece, is poor sleep doesn't always have the same one cause. In traditional medicine, we very often say, well, poor sleep, you need a sleeping pill. But there's so many different things that could cause it. Are you anxious? Are your thoughts racing? Or are you really just not tired? Is your cortisol increasing close to bedtime such that you're kind of stimulated again? You sort of get that second wind, and so you can't fall asleep. Do you have a problem falling asleep, or do you have a problem staying asleep, or is it both? So, and this is why visits take a long time. I spend 90 minutes with my patients on the first visit, is because these are important questions to figure out. Because if you just tell me I'm not sleeping and I say, cool, I'm going to give you melatonin. But what if melatonin's not the problem? What if your melatonin level's fine? Then me giving you melatonin is going to do nothing for your sleep. So
What would cause cortisol to spike other than... Well, what would cause cortisol spike? What are some symptoms? Maybe some, any of them.
Yeah. So traditionally stress is going to cause a cortisol spike, but also anything that's stressful for the body is going to cause cortisol to spike. So things like estrogen spikes and crashes during the menopausal time period, that is a stress on the body. Your cortisol will spike. Mm-hmm. Blood sugar spikes and crashes are stressful for the body. So if you have had, for instance, ice cream before bed, now your blood sugar spiked, your insulin spiked, and then your blood sugar is probably going to crash later, which is also a stress. So both states, high and low blood sugar, are a stressful state, releasing cortisol. So we're demanding of our adrenals to produce more and more and more cortisol. Pretty soon they get tired. So whether we have very, very low or very, very high cortisol levels, when we try to fall asleep, if it's outside of that normal range, we either won't have an easy time falling asleep, or we'll wake up in the middle of the night. And often that sugar crash is at 2 to 3 in the morning. You know, you've had that 10 o'clock bedtime snack and that cortisol is crashing, or the blood sugar is crashing a few hours later, causing a cortisol spike. And cortisol is stimulating. Cortisol is our stress hormones. So if you're that caveman in the cave and your cortisol is spiking for whatever reason, now you're alert and you can't fall back asleep.
Does your body remember if you have a prolonged, proclivity to that? In other words, I went through this and I'm just curious about this because I've talked to a lot of men that have gone through something similar, which is went through a period a few months ago where 2 a.m. I'm up, body's up, go to the bathroom, come back to bed, and I can't fall back. No problem falling asleep, problem staying asleep. So you dive in. Okay, let me not drink 3 hours before bed. Let me not eat 3, 2, 4 hours before bed, whatever. Let's cut out sugar. I went all meat for a while, right? So let's cut out sugar. A bunch of stuff like that. Like, so, okay, I optimized everything. And I did that over the course of, say, a month while this was all still happening. Wake up at 2, not because I had to go to the bathroom, but wake up and because I'm awake now, I got to go to the bathroom. And that wakes me up and I can't get back to sleep.
Yep.
now, even now, I still go through that pattern, even when I'm not doing anything that I would see creating these spikes or drops. So like not eating ice cream or cake or whatever before bed, not eating hours before, ate a great diet that day or whatever. But does my, and also from an anxiety standpoint, I know something that was making me anxious that I cleared. I got rid of it. I did it, right? So does the body remember, or does it need to sort of like reset a habit at a certain point if you've been doing this sleep cycle for a prolonged period?
I think there's some truth to that. I think certainly I probably don't know, and maybe as a medical community, we don't know enough about that effect. But in my gut, that holds true. Like that does sound, you know, I've known a lot of people for whom that's true. We fix all the problems, and then it still does take a little while for their body to get back in that habit. Certainly urinating is one of those things. And there's even, you know, kind of bladder training that we can do to actually say, okay, I have to urinate, but I'm going to wait half an hour and kind of train those, the bladder and even the brain and bladder connection to go, no, we're going to wait a little while. You know, if it has to do with cortisol too, the adrenals can take a little while to kind of bounce back. Mm-hmm. And little things can affect cortisol levels. So even if it's, you know, the bird chirping outside that you didn't realize you noticed, but you did notice, your brain noticed it, that can kind of get you alert again. So there's so many little things.
Or impatience.
Impatience.
Let's say I had ice cream 3 nights in a row and then I stopped doing it for a week and my pattern didn't change. Might be like, the hell with it. It's not working. Back to ice cream.
We're also worried. And sleep causes such worry. So then you're up at 2 a.m. and you go, oh no, I'm not going to fall back asleep. Now you're worried about it, right? Because you're like, because I never fall back asleep. I'm going to have trouble. And it's so important what you tell yourself. What you tell yourself literally affects the cell functions, right? Yeah. So if you tell yourself, oh, I'm going to have trouble falling asleep, you're probably going to have trouble falling asleep. If you picture yourself sleeping, right, you have to like imagine yourself, I'm asleep. Here's how I breathe when I'm asleep. Here's what I experience when I'm asleep. That kind of thing can be really helpful too. So kind of like putting yourself in the state that you want to be.
That's interesting. Yeah, sleep is so central. And it's something I have to really... the Oura Ring. You're the second person today that told me to get the Oura Ring. And I've heard of it before, but it's like, yeah, I should get that. But I struggle with like, well, how does that help me sleep? Like, it's just tracking stuff, just tracking how bad my sleep is. That's going to make me more stressed out.
Well, I mean, for some people it might. And so knowing yourself in that way is important, but if you don't track it, you can't improve it.
True. On Nourish House Calls, you mentioned about getting in the home. That's interesting to me. Like, I could smell the potpourri or the candle or whatever it might be. Happy coincidence? Or does that give you a competitive advantage? And is that just something that you learned about? Or was that the intention of going into the home? The key to life, it isn't money. It's happiness. And when you measure how happy you are, you actually become even more happy. Our friends at GoBundance, the tribe of millionaires, use a very specific tool to measure their happiness. It's called the Life Happiness Index, and you can have it too. Go over to GoBundance.com/LHI and take your Life Happiness Index assessment. You'll rate yourself in multiple categories on exactly how happy you are and get a custom output for you specifically that you can use in developing whatever goals you have for your life. GoBundance is the tribe of healthy, wealthy, generous people who choose to live epic lives. And the tool GoBundance members use at the base of all of that is the Life Happiness Index. Get out there and grab life big.
There was definitely intent to going in the home, and it's turned out to be really good. And it has set me apart in the market because nobody else in this area that I know of, at least, is doing any kind of house call functional medicine. Usually when you think of house calls, you think of people who are homebound and need somebody to come to them. But in my case, the situation is more, my patients have busy lives and they don't want to drive to a doctor's office, wait in the waiting room, then wait in the exam room, and then have a short visit with their provider. So this way I come to you. I'm usually running very on time. If I'm even 5 minutes late, I'm texting to say, hey, I'm so sorry I'm late. Is it still okay if I come, if I get there? You know, because I realize it's not my time, only my time that matters. My patient's time is very valuable too. And that's definitely not the experience you get at a typical doctor's office. Your time matters 0%. It's all their time. So you will wait for them as long as it takes. But if you are late, they will reschedule you. So coming into the home and making patients know that I'm valuing their time is huge.
Is the business scalable in that model, or is that not a concern of yours?
So we're working on that. We are trying to scale. I'm getting licensed in more states so that I can provide even Zoom consults. A lot of what I do is talking with people and discovering issues that way. And there's some physical exam component, and certainly with the IV nutrition and injections, that has to be in person. But a lot of it can be done over Zoom. Scalable wise, you know, adding another provider is going to be what we're going to have to do at some point. I do have a nurse doing some of my IV nutrition therapies for me. I don't want to scale it too huge, though, because part of what patients love about this is the small feel, the personalized attention, and I do not want to lose that. If patients don't feel valued and like an individual, then that gets rid of a lot of the benefit of Nourish House calls to them.
That makes sense. The IV, well, let me this question first. Are there practices like yours that do not have licensed, like you're medically licensed? Are there practices like yours that are not medically licensed?
Unfortunately, there are a lot. So you can get a health coach license, or I'm a life coach, or I'm a health coach, or, you know, people will call themselves functional medicine practitioners even without any kind of license. So you really want to dig and see who is this caring for you? What kind of training do they have? Even non-licensed people are even able now to get accounts at the lab companies, at the professional supplement companies. And so you really want to know who is writing these, you know, recommendations for supplements and lab orders, and do they have any qualifications to even interpret the labs that they're ordering? The law says no, that's practicing medicine. And if you get caught practicing medicine without a license, that's a big deal. Yeah. But I think there are many, many, many of them flying beneath the radar, and they kind of know that they're probably not going to get caught. But there was a recent case in Florida where a guy did get caught doing that. A health coach, you know, was ordering and interpreting labs and making diet recommendations and supplement recommendations based on those labs. And that is practicing medicine without a license.
Wow. May have the knowledge, but you have to have the qualifications to back it up, right? That's like anything. Yeah. So that makes a lot of sense. What states are you currently licensed in, and what states are you trying to get licensed in?
So we're in Illinois. So I'm licensed in Illinois, in Florida, in Vermont, in New Hampshire. And applications are I'm waiting for Washington, Pennsylvania, Oregon, and Arizona, and then Texas and California are next on my list to start. It's a process, and a different process with each one.
Yeah. Is there no reciprocity between states?
So in some cases there is. There's like a compact nursing license, but you have to live in one of those compact nursing license states, and Illinois is not one of those. So even though other states that I'm licensed in are compact states, I don't live in one of those states, and so I have the joy of applying to each state individually.
Got it. I have this idea that I say, you know what, I'm sick of traditional medicine. I want to visit a functional medical practitioner like yourself. Mm-hmm. What does that look like? We talk about sleep. Cool. What else? What else comes with a relationship? Well, you can't speak for everybody. So for you, if I come to Nourish House calls, I live in Naperville, mm-hmm. Illinois. I don't know why I picked that town. What does it look like? What am I getting? Walk me through the process so I have a sense of what a functional medical practitioner does.
Sure. So to me, relationship is really important. And so I do a discovery call with nearly everyone before I see them in person. So they can schedule a free 15-minute kind of discovery call, basically tell me what's going on with them, ask me any questions they have about the practice, about how I operate. And then I can ask them some questions too. I get a real good sense of people that way, and they can get a real good sense of me. And if they're not comfortable with me, or I'm not comfortable with them, then there's not a whole lot of point working together, right? Because, you know, I haven't had any people who I'm uncomfortable with necessarily yet, but I have had a couple people where, you know, maybe they have really bad Lyme disease and what they're looking for is treatment for Lyme disease. And while I know about Lyme disease, I'm not a specialist at Lyme disease. And that's a very, very tricky thing to treat fully and comprehensively. And so I would much rather have I refer them to somebody who is expert at that than kind of try and do the little I know to try and help them, but not really help them. And then they're paying me. And then I feel like I, you know, I'm not doing the best job I can for them. So that discovery call is really, really important. And it also allows them contact with me and eventually with my other providers to kind of gain that comfort before they even spend a penny. Then we do the initial visit and probably the numbers are really good. The conversion rates from that discovery call to an initial appointment are in the high 90s. So if people are looking, they're already in, really.
They're warm.
They're very warm. Yeah. So that's great. I'm not trying to convince anybody of anything. This is information. And if you want to see me, great. And if you don't, no pressure. We have the initial visit. I send forms ahead of time for them to fill out. So all sorts of health history and questions that you've never been asked before about your health, but that do matter. And that gives me a real well-rounded picture of what's going on, what has gone on, when did these symptoms start, and what was the relationship. You know, a very simple example would be, well, ever since I took, you know, antibiotics for that tooth that they pull, I've had alternating constipation and diarrhea, and nobody can figure it out. That's a real common one. So, okay, well, it started after you had antibiotics. So what's going on there? It's not just your typical IBS. Like, there's probably a reason for this, an imbalance for this. So let's figure it out. So a very comprehensive questionnaire. I usually spend 60 to 90 minutes on that first visit with somebody, again, to get to know them, to answer their questions. It doesn't
more
feel
than seven.
More than seven. Yes. Yeah. And so the, whatever, $50 that I would get reimbursed, 30 or 50 from insurance, just is not a business. That's not a business. So the initial visit, and at the initial visit, I usually order labs, you know, blood or hormone, like urine hormone, sometimes stool tests for GI. We can do nutritional evaluations. There's cancer tests and, you know, all sorts of things that we can do depending on the patient and their symptoms and what their goals are. I just saw a patient this morning whose main goals were prevention and aging well. And so those are a different set of tests than for somebody who has very specific symptoms and complaints. Then from there, the follow-up visit happens when we get those lab results back. And usually at that first visit, I'm giving some guidance on general nutrition, general sleep guidance, exercise, how to exercise, what's too much, especially because a lot of people tend to over-exercise. And then at that follow-up visit is when we have the discussion about, okay, well, what do your labs look like? How much support does it look like you'll need? And then let's decide what membership level looks like the best one for you. We have three different levels. We're coming out with actually kind of like a much higher level kind of elite membership package in January. But for now, there are the three. And so then we talk about what is going to be the best fit. I don't want you to overpay, but I also want you to get enough support that you're going to do well. So
makes sense.
That's how it works.
I got you. What does overexercise look like? Can you give me an example of somebody that could overexercise? What's the situation?
So typically it is the woman in her 40s whose body is not looking and behaving like it did in her 20s. She used to do Orange Theory three times a week, and that kept her body in great shape. She didn't really have to worry about what she ate, but now she's really watching it and doing Orange Theory not only three, but four and five times per week. And she's still not gaining muscle, and she's gaining fat, and she's getting heavier. Now she's depressed, and, you know, all these symptoms are coming. So, and now she feels even more run down than ever, too. So she wants to take a nap at 2 p.m. She's not losing weight. Like, she feels like she's crazy because what she knows should work is not working. Mm-hmm. So when I get her lifting weights and building muscle and doing some walking for cardio or some more low-level cardio, she realizes she feels better after those workouts. And one of the things I really stress is tune in to your body. How do you feel after that Orange Theory type workout? And inevitably they're like, oh man, like, I want to take a nap. I can't function for the rest of the day, but like, I got to do it. What am I going to do? I don't want to gain weight. I got to do the Orange Theory. So once they start lifting weights, I ask them, okay, well, how do you feel about after that workout? They go, well, I feel like I could do more. I can go on with my day. I'm like, what do you think that means? Is your body telling you something? Oh, so we're in society, we're taught to ignore the messages from our bodies, right? Well, how do you eat? How do you feel after you eat ice cream? How do you feel after you work out at like way too high an intensity? Oh, it doesn't matter. I know it's good for me. Or I know like, oh, it doesn't matter. What I eat doesn't, you know, matter in how I feel. So we're taught to ignore our body's signals. Well, our body is sending them. And pretty soon we learn to ignore them and not pay attention to them. But if we can tune back in and go, well, how did I feel after that intense, high intensity interval training workout? And if we can then just realize, oh, that didn't feel good. That's huge. Mm.
Women in their 40s seems to be a point of demarcation where they go through so many metaphysical changes or emotional changes as a result. And so they have to, it sounds like you could say to a woman at or about her 40th birthday, like, hey, this is coming. Just heads up, likely. Everybody's different, but here's some things that are very common. Flip that over to men. What's an age and a marker that men should be mindful of, if there is one, where it's things probably, change a lot for them?
It's probably around the same, maybe a little bit later. The symptoms, and again, men, right? It's not manly to admit that you're not able to concentrate or that you can't build muscle. It's not manly to admit a lot of those symptoms of low testosterone. And so a lot of them don't mention it, or they don't mention it because they think, well, I don't want to go on testosterone, so I'm not going to mention it. There are a lot of things even besides just giving testosterone, and I will give testosterone when it's necessary, but there are a lot of things like moderating sugar and alcohol intake that matter a lot in regulating your hormones too. So that would be a place to start. But that age and the symptoms that they may notice, low libido may not be the first thing, but things like inability to concentrate as well, or having trouble getting started on a project, or organizing your thoughts around, okay, I have this project to do. What are the pieces of it? And how do I need to get them done? And how do I organize it? Like, that takes a lot of brain power. And when your testosterone starts to go down, you lose that, that ability decreases. And so now you're feeling like you're losing it and you're a fraud maybe at work. And you're like afraid somebody else is going to find out. So you can't say anything because nobody else can know that you're losing your vitality, your ability to do these things. And then the stress comes of, well, if this continues, I'm going to lose my job. How am I going to support my family and pay for my house? And, you know, so they do get real worried about it if you really ask them and go through this with them. So it's such a comfort to them too, knowing that there's a solution. And they're often told, well, just build more muscle because the muscle is going to help your testosterone levels. And that is true. But if you don't have the testosterone in the first place, you can't build muscle. So sometimes we do need to give testosterone. And it's helpful for so many things, not just sex drive and erectile function.
That's interesting. I just went and got my labs done. And it was in Spanish for testosterone, but I believe it translates loosely to dripping in it. In other words, off the charts. Like, there's so much testosterone. I made the other men uncomfortable. Like, at least that's how I read it. Google Translate.
Did they test free testosterone and total? Did they test the bioavailable? Did they test the sex hormone binding globulin along with it? Did they test your dihydrotestosterone, right? So total testosterone is one thing, but that includes both the testosterone that's free and available to bind at receptor sites, in other words, active testosterone, but that also includes the bound testosterone, so testosterone that's bound to proteins and mostly the sex hormone binding globulin. And if it's bound to a protein, it has no ability to act. So you may have high testosterone levels, but what's bioavailable?
I might have to send you my labs.
Mm-hmm, you may do that.
On that point, one other thing that I've been paranoid about and went and got a bunch of tests on is my heart. Just stress tests, sonograms, all this stuff. Of course, blood work. My LDL is higher than it should be. My HDL is good. Higher than it should be by the, in other words, I have higher good, this is the regular talk on this, right? Like, I have higher good cholesterol, but high bad cholesterol. But then I start reading about cholesterol. And at least what I've learned is it's not all what it seems necessarily. Like, we've definitely got some, but there is still, it seems like, a feeling that overall LDL high, bad. Most of the time. So give me a breakdown on cholesterol. Like, what do we need to be looking at? What's real from your perspective? This is your perspective. Yep. What's real? What needs more research? Hit me.
So my general approach with patients, kind of in my standard lab orders, I do not only the total cholesterol, HDL and LDL with the triglycerides, but I also do the subfractionations of the LDL, so the LDL particle sizes. And then I want to know, and people should know, their apolipoprotein numbers as well. So there's apolipoprotein B and there's lipoprotein little a or LP little a. And those are better markers of actual risk than just a, oh, you have high LDL. So the HDL, yes, you want that to be high. The LDL in general, you want that to be lower, but I would argue that the lab's normal ranges now have way too tight a window. And it doesn't need to be quite that low if your apolipoprotein B and your lipoprotein little a are within normal limits. So, you know, we can also test things like oxidized LDL. So what's the oxidative stress and kind of inflammation level? There's LPPLA2, which is another marker that we can test. A really good resource if you want to really dig deep is Peter Attia. His book talks a lot about this. And then if people's numbers are normal and there's little cardiovascular family history or personal history, then I can kind of let a little bit high LDL ride. You know, I'm not going to prescribe a statin. I think I've prescribed five in my career to five patients who were really, really high and it was really necessary, but I generally don't love to use those. We can also do things like coronary calcium scores. It's a CT calcium that looks at is there a buildup of atherosclerosis or kind of those plaques on your heart arteries? What does that look like? There's also an ultrasound that you can get of the carotid artery called a CIMT or carotid intimal medial thickness test to test for kind of inflammation in that on the inside kind of wall of the arteries. Inflammation is going to lead to plaquing. So there's a lot more, and you're not going to get that in your traditional medical office. That is definitely more specialized. Even a lot of cardiologists, some of them now are ordering some of these tests. But as a general rule, it's something that you may have to ask for. And even all functional medicine providers are not going to know as much about this, because even within functional medicine, there are kind of different specialty areas. So,
interesting. Peter Attia, I believe we have him coming on. His episode is probably going to release in January. So Outlive, big book.
Yes. Yeah, that was a great book. I enjoyed that a lot.
How about cancer? What can you screen for? Like you always, there's a guy that's been on this podcast, Brian Barczyk. He came on right after he got a terminal diagnosis of pancreatic cancer. So he is, it's been less than a year. You know, there's hope that he can extend life, but there's not much hope for him to, you know, to overcome this. It's a very complicated form of a tumor in his pancreas. But it only happened, it only came about, I should say. He only knew about it once he felt the pain. Are there ways of screening for pancreatic cancer, some of these other ones? Or are there certain cancers you just can't catch no matter what you do from a preventative standpoint?
There are always going to be things you can't catch, right? But one of the kind of newer tests on the market is this Galleri test. Tony Robbins actually talks about this one in his book. What is his book? Health Span or something. Anyway, a great book, a long book, but a great book. So this Galleri test is a blood test that tests for about 50 different types of cancer. And many of those are cancers for which we do not have current screening tests. So in the US, we have about five cancers that we screen for. So breast cancer, lung cancer, colon cancer, cervical cancer, prostate cancer. And we're pretty good at screening for those. We're terrible at screening for things like ovarian cancer, pancreatic cancer, bile duct cancers, and those are really aggressive cancers. Yeah. So this blood test tests for, I think it's methylation patterns that indicate cancer growth. And the test comes back as either a positive or a negative. And if it comes back as a positive, the lab will have done the testing to figure out, okay, what were the cells of origin? Was it the pancreas? Was it the bile duct? And then that enables us to get testing, MRIs or whatever the test may be for that particular cancer, to get testing to find that cancer as early as possible so that the outcomes are as good as they possibly can be.
Interesting. Life Force, by the way.
Life Force, yes.
Life Force is the book you're talking about. When somebody is thinking about these sorts of things, like, I'm in a unique spot in the DR everything's covered by insurance. Mm-hmm. Like, it just seems like there's not a lot of like billing codes or anything like that. Like, yeah. I went in and just said, I'd love to get all these tests done. They ordered them, they were paid for. Right. So, yeah, kind of progressive when you think about you know, the perception of like a Mexico DR, like third world or whatever, but private healthcare here is very advanced. So that's great. But generally speaking, if I'm somewhere in Illinois or the US or whatever it might be, and I'm saying, you know, I need all these. I just want peace of mind. I'm not sleeping at night worried about my three friends in the last 5 years that have died of aggressive cancers. Mm-hmm. Am I going to a functional medical practitioner? Is that if there's an easy step to take, is it that? Probably. Or even within that practice or within that industry, do you need to be selective with who that functional medical practitioner is?
You definitely need to be selective, because again, you know, okay, I'm opening a functional medicine practice. I'm a health coach. I had a weekend course and I love nutrition, so I'm a health coach. No license.
No, but licensed is number one.
I would get a licensed person. You just have more opportunity with somebody who's licensed too, because now I'm caring for you. And if it comes up that you need to be prescribed an antibiotic, or you know, maybe you do need that cholesterol medicine for a time while we're cleaning up your diet and we're working on all sorts of things, I can prescribe that for you. A doctor could prescribe that. A nurse practitioner can prescribe that for you. So you kind of have all the services under one umbrella versus seeing your you know, health coach or whoever it is, unlicensed person, then now you have to go to your doctor, nurse practitioner and say, well, my health coach told me I needed this. And the doctor's going to go, what? Mm. So yeah, licensed is important.
But are these sorts of screenings and tests, are they fairly common with good licensed functional medical practitioners?
It totally depends, because it depends what that individual practice or practitioner has been exposed to. I know about Galleri because I read Tony Robbins's book and then I did some research on it. I met with the rep and I now offer that test. So it kind of depends where that specific provider's interests and research have taken them. Mm-hmm. And so that does make it a little bit difficult to find exactly who you're looking for. And again, that's one of the reasons why I offer these discovery calls, because if they're looking for something that I don't provide, I want them to know that before they pay me.
Makes sense. Tell me a bit more about what Nourish is going to do next. What's the plan? What's the vision? You're getting licensed in all these states. Like, you talked about scaling. What's next?
Yeah. So we are coming out with this kind of premier or more elite membership that does include the Galleri cancer screen. It includes a certain like Epitalon peptide twice a year. So Epitalon is a peptide that's really great for anti-aging and for circadian rhythm resetting, so sleep. It includes various testing throughout the year. The price of that is not included in the other membership. So this would be for people who are really looking to be proactive, get down to the nitty gritty, know what's going on with their body, really work on healthy aging. That kind of thing. So that's something we're going to be rolling out in January. Probably pretty soon here. Like, I'm really, really busy with patient care right now, probably busier than I would want to be on a long-term basis. So looking for another nurse practitioner to hire. We do have a nurse doing some IVs for us. And as that gets busier, we may look for another nurse to do IVs. I still want to have my hands in the clinical. Oh, sorry, Lizzie is in the background.
No, that's good.
Barking at the wall, apparently. there she is. But I want to be able to offer this. Lizzie, come here.
My dogs are hanging over there. They've been really good this whole time. I'm actually shocked. So.
Yeah. I want to be able to offer this level of care, individualized, personalized care to more people, and not dilute the quality that I'm able to give. So my main struggle is anybody else going to do as good a job of, you know, doing this as I do? And do I really want to hand it off? And I know I need to kind of, you know, find somebody good and then let them do their thing, right? If I find somebody good, I should be able to trust them. But that's always the business owner's conundrum, is nobody's going to do it like I do. Does that mean I shouldn't grow though? So that's where we're at right now. We're going to be doing the IV nutrition therapy at the GoBundance event in Vermont at the end of January. So excited about that. That's one of the motivations for getting licensed in more states too, is that if people are interested in what I offer, I want to be licensed in a state where I can help them. So part of that was, let's get licensed in a lot of the states, A, that have independent practice for nurse practitioners, and B, where there's a high number of GoBundance members that we could then help.
Makes sense. This mm-hmm. is nourishhousecalls.com. The IVs, what's the benefit? Like, so if you were just to tell me this is why you should do this, what is the reason for me to get an IV in Stowe, Vermont?
Yeah, you'll feel great. It's 100% absorbed into your system. So we give vitamin C, B complex, B12, magnesium, glutathione. We're going to be doing our NAD IVs there as well. So super powerful for brain function, for anti-aging, for cellular turnover. So if you've heard the term cellular senescence before, this really helps with that. Blood flow. Yeah, I mean, you just feel great after doing these. It's just a really great boost.
You and Dave are both now working in the business. Dave was an attorney, left his job. He'll be on a future episode and we'll talk through that a little bit more. What have been I know the highlights. I've been around you too. I've heard you talk about it. You're a great couple. You enjoy working together. You enjoy time together. What have been the biggest challenges in having him and you both full time in this business?
Yeah, the biggest challenge has been parenting. So knowing that we have a lot of work to do in and on the business, but also knowing that we have three kids, two of whom have some special diagnoses, special needs, who need our love and attention too. One of my focuses is I don't want them to look back on their childhood and go, Mom was always too busy for me, or, you know, Dad couldn't come to my baseball game or whatever. So we've been pretty intentional about Dave, and Dave's been great at this too. He barely has missed any sports games for Jude. We'd really try and be home when the kids come home. The twins are 10, Sophie's 12 now. So there's an argument to be made that, yeah, maybe they could come home from school with nobody home. But we want to be home when they're home. We want to have family suppers together. We want to do those things that are going to stand them in good stead for hopefully a healthy adolescence and adulthood. Other challenges, I mean, interpersonal challenge really is not a thing. Dave and I get along really well and work together really well. I would say the biggest struggle is when he criticizes my Instagram videos and then I have to redo them and I hate it. But he says it with good intent. He says it with love. I need to learn to accept his criticism a little bit better sometimes.
You can teach my wife how to do that too. She doesn't do well with that either.
Okay.
Sophie, I know you mentioned is diagnosed with autism. You have Jude, I believe, has ADHD.
Yep.
Is there, I don't know the answer to this. Is there anything in your practice that helps you when managing those two, I don't know, conditions, I'll call them? Is there anything being a functional practitioner that is a superpower for you, or as a result of that, allows you to be even more of an effective parent given those two very challenging dynamics?
And so it goes both ways. So them having this has led me to need to look into that more, right? Because if I can't help my child, who in the world am I going to depend on to help my kids, especially as a functional medicine provider? Medication is not my first option, right? I never want to just say, well, ADHD, put them on a stimulant, right? And a stimulant may be a good piece of the puzzle, a piece of the treatment puzzle for a lot of kids. But I was unwilling to do that until I knew that his sleep was well-regulated, and it was not well-regulated. He was tossing and turning and had these periodic limb movements and stuff. So how's a kid with ADHD going to be expected to behave during the day, or any kid to behave during the day when they haven't slept well? So looking at sleep in these kids is really, really important. So I learned a lot just by my own personal experience, both with the ADHD and then with the autism as well. I learned about lead poisoning and added chelation, IV chelation therapy to my practice years ago because Sophie had been toxic on lead from a Chinese herb supplement that had like 900 times the amount of lead that was allowable. Her level in her blood was halfway to an ICU level, where they would have admitted her to the ICU for constant chelation. So I've learned a lot. And actually, you know, they always say, okay, the troubles that you go through, there's a reason why that happens, right? Well, in a lot of ways, the reason why this happened, this has allowed me to help tons of other families with kids with these diagnoses to feel more in control, to do things that are going to help their kids, whether that's medication or supplements or diet or sleep or whatever it is, but to have a more well-rounded approach to their care that doesn't just mask the symptoms with a medication.
If you want me asking, what was the Chinese supplement that had the high levels of lead? How did that, what was the, if you don't mind, what's the story on that?
So we went to a Chinese doctor who, you know, was a doctor in China, but not here. So again, not licensed here. Whoops. Yeah. You learn your lessons. And so she wasn't sleeping. She would wake up about like an hour or so after going to bed. Eyes were open. She was four or five.
Yeah.
And like for months, she would do this consistently every night. It was not night terrors, because we did the things, like woke her up before they would happen, you know, in terms of the sleep cycle, like kind of trying to prevent that from happening. Wasn't that so, like, three different people, a patient and then my aunt and somebody else, was like, oh, this Dr. Guo, he's the best, take her. I was like, well, I guess it's a sign from God, like, I'll take her there. Okay, so he put her on something, he did his whole Lizzie, come here.
She doesn't like this story.
He did his whole evaluation and put her on one thing, and from that night she slept. It was like a miracle had happened. Wow. And then we kept taking her back to him to kind of reevaluate, and what else do we need to change, and what, you know, energy pathways or whatever were we working on. One of the supplements he put her on, we didn't notice any changes, but the health department called, and then we got an email from the health department and an email from this practice saying, stop taking the supplement. It is, you know, it had killed two children in Illinois alone. I don't know about other states, but two children in Illinois died from the lead levels in this.
Holy crap. And he was the center of it? Was he like the main prescriber of it?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this was his supplement line. So and I asked him, if I remember, because I know that Chinese herbs can be notoriously contaminated. They just don't have the same standards that we have. So I asked him about this, and he said he goes to China, he monitors the production himself and brings them back. And I was like, okay, like, besides me buying a bottle and sending it to get tested, I'm going to have to trust this guy. So I tested her level. Now, a level of 0 is normal, okay?
Yeah.
A level of 40 is go to the ICU and they're going to IV chelate you for however many days it takes. She was at a 19. So, and the medical care was, it'll just get stored in the bones and in the brain. And Lizzie.
Oh my God.
Lizzie, come here. Stop barking at the wall. It'll just get stored in the bones and in the brain. And there's nothing really we can do. Maybe you could give her a little calcium, check her iron levels, make sure she's not anemic so that she doesn't absorb any more iron. That doesn't get rid of the lead, just so that she doesn't absorb any more lead. And I was like, that is ridiculous. So I'm just going to settle for, it'll get stored in her bones and in her brain. Meanwhile, we know that for every point of lead increase above 5, like 5 points of IQ are lost. Like, there's no way.
Wow, I didn't know that. No kidding.
So that's how I did the research and learned about IV chelation. And I've helped a lot of kids and grownups actually since then do IV chelation. IV chelation is something that's a little bit fringe, but I knew how to do it safely. I wouldn't have done it on my own kid if I didn't know I could do it safely. And it's something that not very many people do, because it's a real, real subspecialty. So that was a blessing to know how to be able to do that and to help her too.
Is that the same thing with like metal toxicity? Is it the same?
Lead is a heavy metal.
Right. So, but people like, are most people walking around with more levels of metal toxicity than they realize? Is that a true? I've heard that. Maybe that's a Tony Robbins.
Yeah, you know, it totally depends. It depends on our genetics partially, and what our detox mechanisms are. Do we have these genetic mutations that kind of slow down or inhibit detoxification? That's an issue then, because you could be exposed to the same thing I am, but if my genetics are worse than yours, I'm going to hang on to more of that toxicity, whether it's metals or anything else, than you are. Also depends on diet and sleep and all these other things that are going to affect detoxification. It affects how many affected by how many vaccinations you've had, or where you grew up. Did they have lead in the gas when you were growing up? What about the paint in your house? What about, are you getting a lot of toys for your kids from countries that have higher levels of lead? Are you cooking in dishes that have lead or aluminum or, you know, other heavy metals on them? Spices from India are often contaminated with things like lead. Makeup is often contaminated with lead. Learned a lot of this stuff again when Sophie went through this, because the health department came to my house with their little like laser gun or whatever it was, lead detector gun, and their swabs, and they tested everything. Nothing in the house or outside of the house had lead in it. It was literally a supplement. And I had some of those pills left. And so they tested them, and it was like 900 times the allowable amount of lead in those pills. Yeah.
Gosh. Well, glad to hear she's on the other side of that. But my God, I mean, that's years ago, 7 years ago at this point. So, Mm-hmm. All right. Nourish House Calls is the website, www.nourishhousecalls.com. Yeah. What is the Instagram account that Dave judges you on? Give us that handle.
It's Nourish House Calls.
I really appreciate this. This was like a clinic. This was amazing. Yay. So I appreciate you talking through all of this, and it was great seeing you.
Great. I love the education. So happy to do it.